Well, how much pressure do you feel from the university or from the national lab to pursue patent rights over your...
Oh, they encourage us, yeah. No, every year we get a little memo from Office of Tech Transfer, and they say if you have a discovery that you think might even remotely someday be commercializable, please file a disclosure. They sort of remind you every year to don't overlook that. Yeah. And I think that's really important because, universities can make a lot of revenue, from a patent like that. And it can make, look at University of Wisconsin. I mean, oh my God, they've had a couple of hugely lucrative patents that have allowed them to build new buildings for biochemistry and in the med school. And, it just contributes to the overall infrastructure. It's revenue to the university. And, us public universities desperately need this.
Right.
And to the extent that there could be some intellectual property that comes out of a department of the magnitude of, the vitamin B12 patent, from mm-hmm. Wisconsin,
right.
or stem cell patents, or
right.
something like that, or at Minnesota pharmaceutical chemistry department has a patent on an HIV drug,
mm-hmm.
And, I mean, this is huge. It'd be
yeah.
great if we had something like that. We could fund all of our students, and so, if for no other reason. And also, it just, it brings notoriety to the university. It feeds the economy, because companies can be launched based on this intellectual property.
Yeah.
And that's great for the state.
Yeah.
So I think it's great. I think it's really nice that UC has a relatively friendly policy towards licensing intellectual property and helping faculty who want to start a startup company, sort of being kind of liberal about our time in that regard.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say UC has the most liberal policy because it's a pain negotiating with UC. By contrast, we've licensed some patents at BIOS out of Stanford. It's like smooth sailing. It's so much easier.
Yeah.
They're much more amenable to open negotiation. Because UC is really tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, one thing I'm always struck when I talk about patents is because I'm familiar with the history of patents and why industrial societies developed patent systems. And it's to gain exclusive rights as an incentive mm-hmm. to continue to innovate in societies. And then the opposite side, but important other half of that, is to disseminate technological information. So in order to get those exclusive rights, you have to show your ideas out uh-huh. to the public. And that's what patents are for. And but in the sciences, it's interesting because there seems to be a little redundancy now. There's a whole kind of, we talked about it before, the politics of publication and what publications where mean to careers in science, and which is also the whole point is to put technological and scientific information mm-hmm. out to the community that's going to use it and take it forward. And why not just put all your material in patents or... just all your material and articles, because on that aspect of patents, it's putting information out to the public where it's needed.
Well, oh God, I mean, okay, so the one thing that's true about the patent system is that you can patent pretty much anything and there's no peer review and there's no quality control, so
right.
the patent literature is just full of garbage, The literature is full of some garbage, but not nearly as much. So a lot of patent procedures are very incomplete, intentionally so, often, so that no one actually could repeat it. So actually, patents don't necessarily disseminate all the critical mm-hmm. information. A lot of it is misleading or incorrect intentionally, again, to thwart anyone from duplicating or competing in that area. And of course, there's no way to control it because there's no peer review. So I think of patents as simply legal documents, and I don't put any scientific stock in them. If they're from industry, I might have a little bit higher esteem for them. But from academia, I've seen so much garbage in patents that just violates the second law of thermodynamics. It's impossible, And some patent agent doesn't know that. They just okay, well, I punch in some keywords, it doesn't, conflicts pop up, okay, I'll allow that claim. Mm-hmm. They don't really know,
Yeah.
And then the burden, if you're trying to file a conflicting patent with something to be garbage, then the burden's on you to prove that patent is garbage and you have to challenge that patent and so on. And in theory, in principle, the literature has been peer-reviewed by qualified individuals who pass judgment and catch incorrect things and make, whatever, and just basically exercise some degree of skepticism so that it holds you to a higher standard. So in theory, that's a big difference to me. of course, in practice, it's a little bit gray.
Yeah.
I also think of the literature, like the scientific literature, as a didactic medium. So literature is there to educate you. And so when I write a paper, I write a paper to educate the person. I give them the background and the references, and I explain things, and I show illustrative cartoons of things they might not have known. You know, backup, you know what I mean? So that when they go from beginning to end, they should have learned something new. Whereas a patent, that's not the point of a patent. Patents are not written to educate you. They're written, again, as legal protection, and often they are intentionally written to confuse you, you know, again, to thwart you, to put up barriers and not to invite you in, you know. So a paper should invite you in to a new little world, you know, and that's just a totally different purpose, I think. Yeah. That's how I see it. Yeah. And so for someone whose, you know, career ambition is to have a kind of a scholarly position in academia, they need to demonstrate in the literature that they can educate the public, they can create knowledge and then teach it to you. And a patent, you know, just doesn't serve that purpose. So do we need patents at all? Well, do we need lawyers? if we need lawyers, I guess we need patents and vice versa.
Yeah.
So I just, it's, to me, it's totally different, you know. And, you know, I have no pride in any of the patents that we've constructed. We never wrote any of them anyways. We just wrote disclosures, and the lawyers crafted this impenetrable legalese, you know, that has nothing to do with science.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, so I pay very little attention to how our patents are written. I don't care, as long as the basic claims are in there and we get them.
Yeah. Okay. Just to wrap this kind of area up, it seems courageous in this day and age to start a biotech company after, you know, the great boom and the huge bust of which the Bay Area certainly is reeling from the effects. And not just that small biotech companies, you know, need a hit fairly quickly in order to survive, but also that, big pharma is here, and the pharmaceutical companies are emerging at dramatic rates because they know that the only way they can survive is to have huge R&D budgets. So what are your expectations?
What were we thinking?
Yeah, what are your expectations for this company?
Well, first
of all,
when we started our company, things hadn't really crashed yet.
Okay.
So we were still under the illusion that the economy was going to continue doing really well. So, you know, we formed our company in the beginning of 2001, end of 2000, and at that time the dot-coms were just starting to, like, fizzle out and go under, but everyone saw that as an opportunity for biotech, because usually when some industry crashes, biotech is the fallback, you know, like high-tech crashes, biotech, then, you know, Silicon Valley, biotech, and then internet without biotech.
Okay.
And what we didn't anticipate was September 11th. You know, we started raising money right around September 11th. Like, our first appointment with a VC down in Palo Alto was on September 11th. And when that happened, we were like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? You know, and fortunately, you know, things were really starting to teeter. You know, you could see that something was going to happen. And we managed to sort of keep pounding the pavement. And before things really took a nosedive, we had done our deal. And so we did all right. You know, we had a pretty good valuation. We raised a good chunk of money. $15 million is pretty good for an early stage company. And if we had waited 6 months, we would not have been able to raise $15 million. We'd been lucky to get six, you know, because people weren't investing in that kind of, at that level, in risks of ours. You know, there was very small money and horrible valuations, and it wouldn't even be worth your time. So we barely got in under the wire. And so then what we've had to do, of course, so that was just round A, and we have to raise round B and C and so on, right? We'll be raising money for several years. So we originally had this $15 million, and we had this growth plan that brought us out to like 35 or 40 employees in a year, and then we'd raise round B. And when the economy really tanked, we realized that we were going to have to scale back on our growth plan and try and stretch out our round A money as far as possible, so we didn't have to raise round B for a long time, and we're just hoping the economy picks up. So we're actually now going to start raising round B sort of like September, October, November. We're hoping to close the deal by February or March. So I'm hoping that in the next 6 months, you know, there's kind of, I mean, there is some life coming back to the economy. Mm-hmm, there's right. A little bit more optimism now than there was 6 months ago. So hopefully we manage to ride out the worst year as a funded company. But there's no doubt that when we raise money in the next round, we're not going to have like this huge valuation, you know, like round B companies used to have 2 years ago. You know, we're probably going to have a flat round, maybe even a down round, but we're prepared for that.
Yeah.
But our companies, we're doing well. You know, we have some really exciting stuff. We have an in-licensed compound that we brought in as part of a deal with a big pharmaceutical company. So that gets us a clinical candidate really fast. We'll probably be in the clinic within a year, and I think that'll look good for us and so on. So I think if anyone has a shot, you know, we have a shot, but we're certainly, You know, like a couple of years ago, you know, you could just spout some cool ideas and raise $50 million, you know, and now you actually have to show something and just to get 10.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll gut it out and I'll do the best I can. And so I'm the one who has to give all these presentations to these investors, so it's on me to tell a convincing story and get them excited and have them believe, you know, that what we've got is really something novel and very, you know, promising and high likelihood of success and so on.
Yeah. And how are
you
as
sold?
A co-
I mean, do you believe?
Okay, totally. Yeah. And as a co-founder of this company, how interested would you be if a big pharma company came along and said, okay, well,
here's the deal, we're going to buy you out?
Yeah.
It wouldn't be my decision. I mean, it would be the investor's decision. So I'm not on the board of directors. Hughes prevents me from doing that. Steve is on the board. And then our investors are on the board, and our investors are the majority of the board. So if the investors felt that the deal was better than the prospects for making it on our own, then they would sell our company.
Yeah.
And I don't want that to happen, because I want, you know, a big company buys you for one program usually and then dumps all the rest of it. And we have all these really interesting programs. We have inflammation programs, cancer, even some infectious disease stuff. And, you know, I mean, a big company might buy us for our most advanced clinical program and dump all the rest. And then, you know, I'd feel like, oh, there's so much potential there and it won't be realized now. But it's life, you know, I'm prepared. On paper, I'm prepared. You know, we'll see.
Right.
I mean, what if it happened, I'd be really crushed, you know. Mm. We'll have to spin out Fios 2 or something, you know. I mean, financially, I'd make out really well.
Right.
But
right.
Emotionally, it'd be hard.
Mm. Okay. Well, when you're back here within the walls of the Ivory Tower and you're doing basic research in your lab, how important is it that there is some kind of clinical application to the basic science that you do?
To me?
And the decisions that you make on a daily basis of whether to pursue a project or not.
It's not that important to me. As long as it's interesting in and of itself, you know. If it has a clinical, some long-term clinical relevance, that helps my funding. I mean, it's much easier to write grants.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's really, you know, it doesn't have any obvious practical application anywhere, then it's really hard to sell it, you know, to people. But personally, you know, if something's interesting and, you know, I can fund it, I'm into it. And it doesn't matter if it's going to cure a disease or, you know, I have some projects in nanoscience, nanotechnology, and the applications there are not really clear to anyone yet, you know, but I think everyone's excited about the idea that you can make little machines on the nanometer scale and they might be able to do things that machines on a larger or smaller scale couldn't do, and what exactly they can do for you, we're not all really sure, but it just seems like it's going to be important. And I'm into that, you know. So you know, I have students working on modifying carbon nanotubes with interesting polymers to be able to manipulate them, and there's no clinical application of that I can see. But you know, when the transistor was first built, nobody really knew what all the, you know, I mean, it was like, oh yeah, it'd be cool if you could build this little, you know, I mean, no one really knew that there'd be satellites and like cable TV. And, so sometimes technologies create their own need, you know, and it's just the creation of the technology came from someone's just imagination without an application driving them. I think that's okay. It's a valid way of doing science.
Yeah. Okay, well, another joint venture between private science and public science that had a lot of naysayers originally but has really exceeded everybody's expectations is the Human Genome Project. And what has been the impact on your work as a result?
Well, it's been really useful. So for us, just having access to human genome information, or just genome information in general, not just human, has sort of fast-forwarded projects like the sulfotransferase project and this tuberculosis project. And so instead of like spending years just trying to clone some gene, you've got them all there at your disposal, and it's just a matter of finding what you want, you know. So it just completely obviated the whole chore of cloning things. You know, they're all kind of cloned. You know, they're all the information is there. Just really accelerated, and it just opened up projects in the lab that, you know, wouldn't have been anywhere without it. So for us, it's been really just helpful. It's kind of like having a freeway connecting you from A to B instead of having to take like a million back roads. You know, you're still going from A to B, and B hasn't changed. You still know where you want to go, but you just get there really fast, you know. That's what I think of the genome as.
Yeah.
So that's helpful.
Yeah. Well, it's introduced a new kind of language to science, which was in the midst of, you know, kind of a new language. Biochemistry was transforming itself, cell biology, chemistry. And now we're talking about genomics and proteomics and glycomics. And,
glycomics! yeah, that's and, a San Diego term. Those
okay,
guys invented
yeah, right,
that,
right. And so what does all this new terminology mean to you?
Okay, well, people throw those words around, of course. You know, I don't know. The actual definition of glycomics, I really don't know. You know, I'm not sure we really needed that word, but... what I tell my students, okay, you know, I teach courses, people ask me stuff like that, and what I tell them is that usually people use that kind of omics jargon when they're talking about science. It's the same old science, but it's at the level of a system rather than an individual molecule, that's all. So, like, if you're taking, like, a genomic approach to studying cancer, then maybe what you're doing is looking at changes in expression of all the genes, not just one gene, but all of them at the same time. And a proteomics analysis of something is looking at differences in all the proteins of that cell or tissue, not just one protein. You know, so in the past, you might study interleukin 2, okay, it goes up at sites of inflammation, but a proteomics approach would look at all the proteins. And so there's nothing sort of conceptually different with respect to looking at all the proteins versus one protein. The difference is that you need to look at all the proteins, a very like high-throughput parallel technology to do it. So omics to me is about doing system-wide analysis and often using high-throughput tools just to cover that much information in a short period of time. So glycomics, you know, you could say that glycomics is science that somehow seeks to analyze like all of the polysaccharide structures of a cell or tissue all at once and maybe changes in those polysaccharides as the cell changes its state. So you can have a glycomics approach to studying cancer, so the glycomics analysis of inflammation. That's kind of how I think of it.
Yeah.
But I didn't coin any of those terms.
right. Well, you have described yourself as interested in carbohydrate chemistry, and what's your relationship to glycomics?
I don't really feel the need to use that term to describe my research, because I think there are other terms that describe it, but... The truth of the matter is that the NIH has been convinced that it should be funding glycomics.
Okay.
So I'm more than happy to put that term in my grant proposals, you know. But in terms of system-wide analysis, we do have some projects in the lab that have that flavor to them. So, for example, I have a student that, student just poked his head in here, most recently, a shaved head. This is Howard, and he's interested in developing chemical tools that would allow you to probe like all the proteins that are modified with a certain type of sugar. And so as an example, there's a class of glycoproteins called O-linked glycoproteins. And so what they all share in common is that there's a polysaccharide linked to the oxygen, the O, of serine or threonine. Okay, and it's really hard to predict which proteins are going to have these sugars on their serines or threonines because there's no consensus sequence for it. So you know what I mean by that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So because of that, you can't just look at the sequence of a protein and say, oh, that serine will have one of these sugars on it, because there's no sequence that would tell you that. So how do you know which proteins have that sugar on it? Well, you can isolate each protein one at a time, pick them apart, and look for these sugars, but that would be very slow. And so that's not very omics, right? But omics would mean figure out a way to look at all of them at once very quickly, just high throughput, you know, the whole system. And so he developed a tool for that. And so what he does, so it turns out the one commonality among all these O-linked sugars is that they have as the residue that's hooked directly to the protein, N-acetylgalactosamine. It's called GalNAc for short. And it turns out that if you feed cells modified forms of that sugar GalNAc that have a functional group called an azide, N3, which is going to get us to the Staudinger ligation in a minute. So the azide is just three little nitrogens, and it's pretty small. And you can kind of attach it to GalNAc. So now you have GalNAc with this little azide sticking up. And you feed that to cells. And the cells will kind of eat it and metabolize it, and they don't know that there's an azide on it. And they'll actually put it into all these O-linked glycoproteins at that core position in place of the regular GalNAc, which you've deprived them of. And so now there's this azide hanging out in their GalNAc, and that's nothing that would interfere with, you know, it just kind of comes along for the ride, it's inert. Mm-hmm. But the azide has a unique chemical property, which is that it can react with these reagents that we developed in this Staudinger ligation. So anytime you have an azide, it's like a little Trojan horse, and you can basically tag it with a probe. And so now what you could do, you can imagine, is you feed the cells this GalNAc with the azide, all the Olink glycoproteins get the GalNAc with the azide, and they're just hanging around. You break open the cells, take all the proteins, all of them, all at once, and you mix them together with this phosphine reagent. And now the phosphine now swim around, and it's only going to react with the azide, and it's going to attach itself to all the proteins that have these O-linked sugars, but no other protein. And now all you do is you separate out all the proteins, and then you probe which are the ones with the tag, and those are the ones that had the O-linked glycoprotein. So that could be construed as a glycomics. We don't call it that, but it's a system, it's a tool for system-wide analysis of proteins modified with O-linked sugars. Howard calls it glycoproteomics.
Glycoproteomics, okay.
And, you know, that's his little word, so, you know, I have to use that word. But, okay. But you know, so other people might say, oh, yeah, it's glycomics, you know.
Yeah, okay.
But the guys in San Diego have a, I don't know, they haven't, they don't really have a very clean definition for it. Yeah. It's just, it's a funding, it's a marketing tool.
Yeah. Okay. Well, to start moving in that area, a couple of things I wanted to talk about was here at Berkeley, you have several different, you wear several different hats in several different departments. You have two different appointments at the National Lab in Material Sciences and Physical Biosciences, Chemistry Department, Molecular Biology. You mentioned your tiny pharmacology mention at UCSF. And
so where am I? That's a good question.
Well,
I don't know.
I know that your office is in the chemistry department, and you clearly identify yourself as a chemist, but what does it mean to have all these different hats?
A lot of committee meetings and, you know. I mean, okay. What it means is I'm 100% in chemistry, so I teach 100% in chemistry. Mm-hmm. I'm 0% in molecular and cell biology, so I don't teach there. But my face appears in their little catalog, which makes it easier for me to recruit students from that department, which is really helpful to my research program. I'm in the material sciences division at LBL, which means I get a little lab space up there, and I get money through that division. The physical biosciences division hasn't really done anything for me. I thought I'd get money, so they asked me if I would sort of like be affiliated with their program, but I don't really get money through physical biosciences. I get a little bit of money, but it's a long story. It doesn't really count. And so not really sure what I'm getting out of that, but I'm there for whatever it's worth. I think, you know, my name, it looks good to have my name kind of affiliated with the group somehow, because I'm a biologist. What else am I? So the reason I have an appointment at UCSF is that Howard Hughes has a rule that you have to be affiliated with a medical school to be a Hughes investigator. So Berkeley doesn't have a formal medical school. Mm. So all of us Hughes investigators at Berkeley have been given courtesy appointments at UCSF just on the books. Yeah. And what that means in practice is I could get a student from UCSF to join my group if I wanted to, or if they wanted to, but the truth is that they have a small graduate program and they have 400 faculty there, so statistically, why would I ever get a student from UCSF? Although, the other thing I get is there's special little funding pots for faculty at UCSF, like some very wealthy donor will donate some bunch of money to the med school to fund prostate cancer research, and then anyone affiliated with UCSF can apply for this money. So I actually have money through UCSF to work on prostate cancer. And I wouldn't have had that if I wasn't a UCSF faculty member.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what difference does it make if you're sitting in your, or working in your office here, or up in the National Lab, which is just up the hill from here? What difference does it make the way you approach your science if you're in?
I don't know, because I've never really sat up there. I pretty much have always sat here.
Okay.
And I have a lieutenant up there that I hired. she's great. Her name is Gia Song, and she's was a postdoc in my lab for a couple of years, and then I kind of hired her as like a uber postdoc, you know, sort of a staff scientist, sort of. And she kind of oversees the whole lab up there, and like she's kind of independent a little bit, but she still kind of works in my grants and so on. And I used to have like 3 or 4 postdocs up there, but I'm sort of converting that lab. So we have this thing called the Molecular Foundry, which is a new nanoscience institute that's under construction at LBL, and I'm the director of the Biological Nanostructures Facility, so you can put that on the list of things. So what that means is I design the labs, which are sitting here in a blueprint, and I'm going to hire staff to fill up that institute, and that's the vision of that institute is to do nanoscience, but to bring to bear on that, like biology, chemistry, physics, theory, everything. And I'm in charge of the biology group. So I'm going to hire out, like, you know, 30 or so people to sort of fill this institute, and I've already hired Gia as my, like, lead, like, whatever, like, lieutenant, main person. So my lab at LBL right now I'm using as kind of temporary space for the Molecular Foundry. So I'm hiring people into the foundry, but they're working in my lab at LBL, and eventually they'll move to that building, but it won't be finished until 2006. So that's kind of what's going on up there. So if I were, you know, there are people who certainly, I mean, they have full-time staff at LBL who work up there, and it's nice and quiet, and you have a beautiful view. It's not really well equipped for chemistry and biology. It's much better equipped for physics, engineering, that kind of stuff, just historically. We're trying to fix that so that it's a little better for chemistry. And then maybe I could take an office up there. I think I'm supposed to have an office in the Molecular Foundry. But the problem is, you know, I like to be near my students. The students like to be on campus because that's where all their student stuff is. And my students are my bread and butter. You know, they kind of heart and soul of my lab and sustain me. You know, so it would be hard for me to be physically separated from my students, because then if I'm having a nervous breakdown, I don't have anyone to talk to. I need to have my students. I go to the, like, event and rant and rave, and I can come back in here.
Okay. Well, in your Pew proposal, you stressed the interdisciplinary nature of your work.
Did I?
And yes, you did. As why,
this is like one of the very first things I ever wrote here.
Justification of why you should be funded, because you're one of the few who are doing interdisciplinary work, and clearly by, you know, just what we've been talking about, that, you know, you have tried to approach this as interdisciplinary, but also the structure, though, within the university exists that you have all these different appointments. There's no one centralized place for you. How well do you think you've been able to, you know, achieve this goal of interdisciplinary research?
I think I'm the most interdisciplinary person on this campus. I mean, in the sense that just the composition of my lab would underscore that. Because I have postdocs who are, like, from backgrounds in immunology, synthetic chemistry. I have grad students from biology, from chemistry. I have a physical chemistry student. I've had physics postdocs come here and work for me. I've, you know, published in biomaterials journals all the way to, like, science and stuff and everything in between. So I think that I have achieved that, and too much in a way. Like, it's my eyes are bigger than my stomach or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it's so broad that I'm losing it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have the expertise to cover it all. And so we're getting out into areas where I feel like I can't ever really command the area. I don't have the time, you know, to just develop that much sort of knowledge in all these different areas. And I'm worried I'll go out and give a seminar on that topic and be exposed as a fraud. You know what I mean? So I've actually reached a point where I do feel like I need to kind of somehow get a little more focused. Like, mm-hmm. to sort of herd some of these sheep back in a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think we're just incredibly broad right now. Yeah. It's been good for me. I mean, it's really, I've learned a lot, but being in charge of, like, a nanoscience facility and running a lab in chemistry and biology and having projects in prostate cancer and tuberculosis and inflammation and doing the microscopy and the synthesis and all the animal work, I mean, it's just a little overwhelming sometimes, and it costs a fortune. So I spend a lot of time writing grants.
Yeah. Okay, well, then to go on there is, you know, how well have you been able to attract funding when, again, you know, even funding agencies are set up? The NIH has a million study sections, and not every chemist applies to the NIH for its own funding, for funding. And you're a Howard Hughes investigator, and how has being this interdisciplinary person?
Well, it gives me access to a lot of different pots.
Okay.
So there's that. I shouldn't say it on the record. I have enough money.
Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I have too much money, but cause you can always have more. But I have never had, funding has never been a limitation.
Okay.
At least I haven't felt it as a limitation. I've never not been able to take students or postdocs because of funding. It's been space has been my limitation. Okay. And just, like, being able to just handle it, you know, psychologically. But my major funding source is the NIH. I have 4 R01s.
Wow.
And it's a lot of work to keep them up,
yeah.
You know, and some of them slip through the cracks sometimes, and I don't know if I can sustain them indefinitely, but right now at this moment I have 4.
Yeah.
And I'm a junior investigator of Hughes,
okay.
So that means I don't get, like, a shitload of money from Hughes. I get, like, it's good money, you know, but
right.
It's not, like, the majority of my lab. I mean, it's like, you know, my Hughes budget is, right now it pays for 2 technicians, 1 postdoc. It used to be 2 postdocs, but we had to cut our budget, so I had to slash a postdoc. And then it pays my salary, and it pays, and then some research supplies. And the research supplies is probably on the order of, like, an NIH grant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's not, So, you know, the big things are my four R01s. And then I have some money from, like, this prostate cancer organization. I have some money from Johnson & Johnson's pharmaceutical company. And then I have substantial funds from from LBL. So this is the great thing about LBL. It's a source of money. It's DOE money.
Yeah.
And I probably bring in, I'd say my total operating budget for a year, like, direct costs, you know, is probably in the order of $2 million.
Wow.
It's a lot. I'm not the biggest sort of spender in the department, but I'm probably second to the biggest. And I have probably the second largest lab. I mean, I have a lot of people. It costs a lot of money to do what we do. But the reason I can tap into so many funding sources because I can get money to do tissue engineering from LBL. I have money to do for nanoscience projects from LBL. Then I have four grants from the NIH, and there's like the sulfotransferase grant and this glycoproteomics grant. I have a metabolic engineering grant and a tuberculosis grant. And and then I have the Hughes money, it's unrestricted. And then J&J pays for a tumor imaging project. And, you know, they have little awards and things, just little things, you know, that I have. And any one of those projects you could have a whole lab work on. And in MCB, that would be more the style.
Mm-hmm.
But in chemistry, you know, we just have this, there's kind of a, I don't know, the culture is more like, more is better, kind of just, everyone's always trying to more, you know, just push yourself to the limit, extend yourself as far as possible to see where you snap. That's kind of like
right.
what we do.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but.
And you're
tenured. See, that's why I need really good students and postdocs, because otherwise I'm like, all these balls are up and it could just crash, and you have to have these really good people you can delegate to. And I do. Really good.
And why is it that you've been able to attract good students?
It's Berkeley, you know, they're all good. I mean, most of them, you know, I think are really good. It's Berkeley. What can you say? You know, I mean, I'm nice to them. I mean, I treat them pretty well. I mean, occasional lapses, you know, but we have some really good people. And then they beget each other. So you get a few good students and postdocs, and then they'll recruit people in. Like, they now recruit really good people in and kind of keep it going. So I owe them a lot, you know.
Yeah, okay. You have tenure here in the chemistry department, and what does tenure mean?
Other than the obvious,
that you can't get fired, but
that's what I meant by the obvious.
If all your R01s suddenly, all those balls that you kept in the air suddenly,
no. If my worst nightmare materializes, the NIH goes bust, none of my grants get renewed, Hughes boots me out. What would I do?
Yeah, what would Berkeley do to your lab space?
Oh, you know, the usual. They take it away and give it to the next rising star, and I'd be, you know, a cautionary tale and butt of jokes and gossip at bioorganic Gordon conferences and stuff.
And how much does Berkeley cover your salary?
None. Well, Hughes pays my salary.
Okay.
So, because I'm a Hughes investigator. If I wasn't, then I'd get 9 months from Berkeley, and 3 months would be off of
my grants,
yeah, okay. Which was my situation before I became a Hughes investigator, and is the standard situation here.
Yeah.
Although sometimes, like, grants, like I have LBL money, I used to pay 2/9 from, like, NIH, and I used to have an NSF grant, and then 1/9 from LBL.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I guess I'll turn now to, because we've been interviewing on Sunday, and when I left you yesterday, you were just getting started with your students, and it's 9:30 on a Monday night. how do you balance a personal life with your professional life if you are here, as it seems, all the time, or else on the road?
I guess, well, what qualifies as a personal life? Like relationship?
Yeah, a long-term family, relationship, yeah. Or you mentioned that you don't have children.
No, not for lack of effort.
It
just didn't work. We tried.
Yeah, okay.
I had envisioned that as being something that I would have, but it just, you know, we tried for about 2 years, and it cost a fortune. So, you know, for us it was a little complicated because my partner's female. So,
right.
You know, this was for us an investment, you know. And, I mean, it's hard, you know, the balance. I'm not a very good balancer. I get absorbed. I'm a workaholic. And, you know, my name is Carolyn and I'm a workaholic. So, Yeah, I mean, you know, I've had times in my life where I had did better job than others, I think. I did a pretty good job at that when I was a postdoc, I thought, actually. At UCSF.
Yeah, good balancing, job at balancing.
Going home. Like, okay, so I've been in the same in a relationship for 15 years with same person who I met here as a grad student, as a first-year grad student. And she was a grad student in the public policy department. And when I was a student, I worked really hard, actually. We were here all the time. I worked for a new assistant professor, and it was a total grind, you know. But I liked that, and it was part... You know, lab is your social environment in addition to your work environment, and you working with your friends. And so I never felt like coming to work was somehow separate from my personal life. It was kind of all, like, woven around this building, you know, and this was, like, my scene. And we had as much fun here as we had work, you know, and I hung out with people here, and you goof around a lot when you're in the lab and stuff. So that didn't seem so bad. And my partner used to come over and hang out, and she became friends with all my friends in the lab, and we were all just friends. We all hang out together, and it was just a scene, you know. And then when I was a postdoc, we really had a good time because I felt a little more relaxed. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, I had been in the situation where I was, like, trying to run this lab and get grants. You know, I was sort of had a lot thrown on me as a grad student. And as a postdoc, I was relieved of that. I finally just got to do research. And we lived in San Francisco, which was... like incredibly cool. We moved to Noe Valley, which is a totally funky neighborhood, and then I also met, like, that was the first time I'd ever worked with women in my lab. Like, so when I was a grad student, I was the only woman in the lab, which was typical because of the numbers back then. But I had these great guys, and we were really good friends. And when I went to UCSF, that was the first. There was all these women in the lab, and I was like, whoa, there's, like, women here. It's so cool. And so I made all these really good friends, and then my partner, her name is Cynthia. She made sort of friends with them, too. Like, she would come and hang out with all of us, would hang out together. And so she was as much part of that social scene as I was. And sometimes, like, she would come to the lab, like, even if I wasn't there. Like, which sounds sick, I know, but she would, you know, just to visit people and then go out to movies with them and stuff. So she has remained really close friends with some of those postdocs I worked with in Steve's group. And it's just, you know, biology, the labs in biology have just a more mellow culture than in chemistry. Chemistry is has a kind of grinded out, like, 90-hour work week sort of. Like, we used to have group meeting, like, when I was a grad student, we had group meetings Saturday night at 10 p.m., and that was the standard, you know. And my boss said to us, well, you know, you don't really get much research done Saturday night at 10 p.m., so you might as well have group meeting. You know, we were like, yeah, okay. And so this was normal, you know. Whereas in biology, people don't live like that. You know, they go home in the evenings, and it's just different culture. So at Steve's lab, you know, Steve would go home at 6. And he worked really hard, you know, from 8 to 6. But at 6, he went home, and he had dinner with his family and his kids. And I'd never seen that before. That was, you know, I was like, wow, you can go home? That's weird. You know, they, like, eat in their house? Would they have food in their house? God, like, what do they do with it? You know, who cooks it for them? You know, I mean, it was so foreign to me. And so... whereas Cynthia, my partner, has always had a very normal lifestyle. Like, she would never take a job that demanded more of her time than, like, 8 to 5. She refuses. She's like, I have to have this. She has to go to yoga class and her book club and friends and just stuff. She does stuff, you know, volunteers for this and that. And so she's very much resisting. She would never be a workaholic, just refuses to do it. And if her job is like, well, you have to stay, like, late all the time, she'd be like, forget it. I'm not going to do it. So she always thought we were kind of insane, all of us scientists. But she sort of put up with it because she thought, and I used to tell her, oh, well, I'm in grad school now, and I have to do this. But, you know, eventually, you know, I won't be, and then everything will be normal. Right. You know? And then there was a hint of that when I postdoc, because I had a little bit more normal life. Like, I would come home some nights for dinner, not every night, but some nights. And I would take off Sunday. You know, I wouldn't go in every single day on the weekend. And so she kind of got this hint, oh, Carolyn is really going to... And then I took my job here, and it was just right back to the old way. And then some, you know. Yeah. So the first year I was on the faculty, I don't think I took, like, a day off, and I don't think I came home for dinner once. And she got pretty fed up. And after about a year, she was like, I'll see you later. And so I had to kind of clean up my act. Yeah. So that was my lesson in balance. But actually, I've still never really gotten very good at it. And what happened is she changed professions at that time. She quit her job, went to nursing school. And when she was in nursing school, she had a pretty extreme schedule. Mm-hmm. And so then I was like, oh, good, I can, like, sneak out and work late, because she won't be home till midnight. So, and now I think she's just, after 8 years, you know, she's just finally just resigned to the fact that I'm never going to have a normal life, that I'm going to be on the road a lot, and that, you know, I'm going to be home at 11, you know, so, and that maybe once or twice a week I'll come home earlier for dinner or something, but, you know, it's hard.
So how much effort do you make time to spend time together?
Well, I think I make all this effort, but I'm sure by a normal person's standards, it's quite pathetic. And
yeah.
So, I might take a day off on the weekends. You know, like, last Saturday, came back from Australia, I got back at, like, noon, and I didn't come to work. I stayed home, so that was,
oh, my goodness.
That was an event, yeah.
Yeah.
And then Sunday, I came in, of course, but, no, I've been better about, like, trying to take time off. But also, since Thio started, to be perfectly honest, it's been really hard, you know. I've been, every free moment I get, I feel like I need to spend with Thios, you know. So Thios has become, like, my other sort of hobby, I don't know, my, outside of work. Mm-hmm. Cynthia would call it my mistress, but, you know, it's sort of... Mm-hmm. It's very time-consuming.
Yeah. Well,
it's not easy. I definitely stink at it. It's a problem. It's hard on the relationship. Cynthia's heroic to put up with the crap, you know, and so on. And the worst part about it, of course, is that my students, not everybody wants to live an extreme life like I do, right? Most, in fact, people don't.
Okay.
And the worst part about it is that my students, particularly my female students, look at me as a freak and think I'm like their anti-role model.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, I don't know what I want to be necessarily when I'm in my own career, but I know I don't want to be like you. And of course, for women in science, that's, you know, all our lives we're like, I want to be a role model. I want women to look at me and say, oh, look, she's doing this, I could do this too. And in fact, I think I have quite the opposite effect on my students. They're like, look at her. She's like at 11 o'clock here every night. She never sleeps. You know, she's flying around all over the place. And I don't want to live like that. You know, and if that's what it means to be an academic, I don't want that job. And I feel terrible about that because the truth is that I have a lot of colleagues who don't necessarily do that. They're much better. They have families at home. They go home. Like my sweet mate next door, he works really hard, but he leaves every day at 5:30 because he has young children at home. He gets in every day at 5. You know, he's here at 5 in the morning. But the students see him leave at 5:30. That's what they see, and they're like, "Oh, you know, man, family." And you know, I could see myself being like him. And you know, we have in our department, you know, 45 men, and there's a man of every type. So you could find a guy probably who you can relate to. But there aren't that many women. There's just a very few of us, and I might be the only one that some of these students ever see. And if I'm the only woman they see, and I live like this, as far as they can see, that's the way you have to live as a scientist. They don't have enough of a diversity of personalities to relate to among their women faculty. You know what I mean? And I can't, you know what I mean? So some of them might look at me and see how I live and say, oh yeah, that's really exciting. She gets to fly around and she's so intense about her work and she's always making time for us and she'll stay up late to finish her paper and how great that is. And I want to do that. But that's going to be a small minority. A lot of them, they envision a different lifestyle for themselves. And there might be women leading that lifestyle in academia, but they don't see it, because all they see is me. So this keeps me up at night. I lose sleep over this. I don't know what to do about it, to be perfectly honest.
Okay. Let me flip the tape over.